You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up, beds are such a common piece of furniture that we don't tend to think about them much. But throughout history, they've been much more than a place to sleep. We'll visit with the author of What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. Now, opioid prescriptions are more common in rural areas. Residents there often tend to be older, and they may deal with more injuries from strenuous jobs that take a toll on physical health. But despite the fact that rural areas prescribe opioids more often, those same communities are often lacking sufficient addiction treatment options and providers. Our next guest recently profiled a doctor in Nisida, Wisconsin, who's trying to help change that. Bram Sable-Smith is the WPR Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at the Wisconsin Center for Investigative Reporting. Bram, thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks for having me, Judith.
Can you talk a little bit about the differences we see between urban and rural areas in opioid prescriptions and addiction?
Yeah, it goes across the board in health, really. There's a single line that I feel like I could write in every story I do on rural healthcare, which is that blank is not as available in rural areas as it is in other ones. So if we're talking specifically about opioids and addiction treatment, so rural residents are 87%. They have an 87% higher chance of receiving an opioid prescription than their urban counterparts. The overdose death rates in rural areas are significantly higher than an urban one. Since 1995, rural deaths related to drug overdose have increased by 325%. In urban areas, it's increased as well, but only by 198%. So it's a very significant disparities in rural areas.
So those figures are pretty shocking. Why are opioids so much more common in rural areas? Why are they prescribed so much?
Well, across the board, we've seen an increase in opioid prescriptions beginning in the late 1990s and progressing until about 2010 to 2012 is where they really peaked, and that's across the country. Since 2012, we've started to see those prescriptions decline, but in rural areas, they remain significantly higher than in urban ones, and part of that is because there's a lack of specialists. Pain management is it's part of family medicine, it's part of primary care, but it's also its own additional specialty that requires additional training. So too is addiction treatment. And both of those specialties, as well as specialties in general, are not as common in rural areas. That's because generally specialists don't have, in rural areas, there's not the patient base to sustain a practice for a specialist.
So, Bram, you profiled Dr. Angela Gatzke-Plowman in this piece. Tell us about her.
So Angela Gatzke-Plowman, you might consider her a unicorn. We have a shortage of primary care physicians, a shortage of physicians in general in rural America, in rural Wisconsin, and across the country. Angela Gatzke-Plowman, along with her husband, Dr. Ryan Plowman, who's a pediatrician, in 2010, when they were finished with their medical training, they decided that they wanted to move somewhere in rural Wisconsin. And that's a very uncommon thing. I actually found a story. David Wahlberg at the Wisconsin State Journal profiled them in 2010 as they were choosing which one of the communities they're going to move to. So Angela Gatzke-Plowman, she's the only full-time physician in Nisida, Wisconsin. That's in Juneau County in central Wisconsin. It's a village of about 916 people, and she treats everybody and everything in a large catchment area around that area. So she does beginning of life care. On the day that I was profiling her, she checked in on a baby she had just delivered the day before. She treats end of life care and everything in between, and that includes a significant number of patients on opioid prescriptions.
And when she started her practice there, she realized that there was quite a problem, but it really came to a head when she was trying to find options for some patients who were really asking for help because they had become addicted to opioids. What did she find or not find as far as resources?
That's right. In around 2016, she received a phone call from a patient who had been on opioids. She'd been prescribed him opioids for a legitimate and severe pain problem that he had had. And he admitted to her in this 2016 phone call on a Friday afternoon that he lost control and he needed help. And the two of them sat there on the phone Googling for places where he could go somewhere in the area. And there wasn't anything available. Eventually, he did get treatment about 65 miles away from Nisida, but there weren't the resources available to him in that community. And she decided she needed to change that. And so she got it's called a waiver to prescribe a drug called buprenorphine. So this is an effective opioid addiction treatment. It's often known by its brand name, Suboxone, which is a buprenorphine treatment that's mixed with naloxone, which is the kind of opioid antidote, some call it. So she got you need to get a waiver from the federal government. She got waivered to start prescribing this, and that's what she's done. Beginning in 2018, she started prescribing buprenorphine to a few patients in the community.
We're talking with Bram Sable-Smith right now. He's the WPR Mike Simonson Memorial Investigative Reporting Fellow at Wisconsin Watch, and we are talking about his profile of a doctor in Nisida, Wisconsin, who is trying to deal with opioid addiction while also making sure that her patients who need serious pain relief are able to access it. And Bram, I want to play a little audio that shows some of the higher level monitoring that Dr. Gatsky Plowman does for opioids. This is her speaking with a patient named Michael Crichton.
If I ask for something, like if I ask to have a urine drug screen to make sure that you're not using other substances, that you'll do that. And if I ask for a pill count, that you'll come in and we can count your pills at any point, which is something that I don't always do just because I suspect somebody of doing something wrong. I just do that for all of my patients.
So in reading your piece and in hearing that short portion of a conversation that she's having with a patient, it's a lot of monitoring. Are patients on board with that?
For the most part, yes. Michael Crichton's on board with it. When she started making a concerted effort to reduce the number of patients she had on opioids, she began with about 30 and now it's about 7 to 10. There were a few patients who disagreed with that and left her practice. But for the most part, the patients stayed in and started doing alternative treatments, exercise, physical therapy, different types of treatment like that that can be alternatives to opioids. Most of her patients did stay on board and went along with that. And what she's talking with Michael Crichton in that clip we played, that's a medication treatment agreement. So this is a best practice now in opioid prescribing. When she started in 2010, 2012, she had a form of this. But in around 2016, her hospital standardized that every physician in their practice who is going to be prescribing opioids would have to use this contract, this agreement that they go over with the patient at least once a year, that basically lays out the rules and regulations for getting an opioid prescription.
It seems like that would be very difficult to do if you had, say, 100 patients instead of 10 or 20. But in that community, she's it, right?
That's right. Yeah, it's very time consuming. I talked to an expert at the University of Minnesota who described this type of work as low tech, but high importance. So it's a lot of time. You spend a lot of time with patients treating, you know, most of the patients who are on opioids for chronic pain. That's not the only reason they're going to see their family doctor. There's all kinds of other co-occurring conditions. And so she's treating all of that. Yeah, it's all in her.
So you said that she had to get the okay from the federal government to prescribe buprenorphine. I'm guessing that since she had to go through that process, that is probably not the case in a lot of communities. There is not just only one, there's no one at all.
That's exactly right. So in our analysis, we found 18 counties in Wisconsin alone that don't have a single clinician who's a registered, licensed buprenorphine prescriber. 14 of those counties are rural ones. So that's another one of those disparities that significantly impacts rural communities more so than urban ones.
And talking with Dr. Gatsky Plowman, does she see a turning point in her community with this new approach that she's taking? Or did you get the sense that she still feels like she's really kind of swimming upstream?
Well, a really important thing that's happened is in 2017, nurse practitioners and physician assistants were allowed to start prescribing buprenorphine as well. They are required to take more time to get their waiver to prescribe it, but they can prescribe it as well. So it's not just Dr. Gatsky Plowman who's prescribing buprenorphine now. She oversees one nurse practitioner who does as well, and another one of her nurse practitioners in her practice is going to start prescribing it soon. Hopefully he's getting his training. And so with that, you know, it's hard to bring this in. She says she already has a full practice and it's hard to bring in addiction treatment, but she thinks it's something that's worthwhile. And as she can get more providers in her practice who are doing that as well, they can kind of share that burden.
Well, Bram, thanks so much for joining us and a really, really interesting profile that you did.
Thanks so much.
That was Bram Sable-Smith, an investigative reporting fellow with Wisconsin Watch and WPR. He was with us today to talk about the story of a doctor in Nisida, Wisconsin, who's bringing a new approach to dealing with opioids to her community. If you want to read more about the story, you can find it linked on our website, wpr.org/centraltime. Coming up, kids love garbage trucks, and one fearless reporter set out to find out why. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson. Coming up, we'll talk with a reporter about her hard-hitting look at why kids love garbage trucks. Right now, it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Carl Christensen with a story about how watching your parents dance as a child shapes the legacy you leave behind with your own children.
Have you ever been at a wedding and caught a glimpse of your parents slow dancing? Maybe you marveled, or maybe you cringed, but I'm willing to bet you felt something. Jan Larson shares a story about how watching her parents dance in the kitchen brought her comfort as a child, and now as a mother as she watches her children forge their own affections.
The legacy parents leave their children isn't always easy to spot. On those rare occasions when we get a glimpse of something good, it is oh so sweet. As a child, I delighted in my father's nightly ritual. He would sneak up on my mother as they cleared away the dinner table or wiped down the countertops, and what was our kitchen? Transformed into their private ballroom dance floor. I only have eyes for you. He crooned tenderly as he wrapped his arms around her, his face nestled into that space along the back of her neck and shoulder. Gently, he twirled her around, ignoring her mock protests, and swept her into his arms in a glide across the linoleum floor. The moment was brief, enchanting, and one that left a young child certain of her parents' love. All was right with the world. Some years later, I met and married my own darling. And then, one night while tidying the kitchen, I felt his arms wrap around me, hands turning me to face him as he guided me in our own dance across the hardwood floor. Happy tears pricked at my eyes as he twirled me, pulled me close, and then finished with the big dip. As toddlers, our children squealed with pleasure at Daddy's strength and the light in Mom's eyes. As teens, they offered eye rolls, shoulder shrugs, and the predictable, get a room, to which we replied, we have a license, marriage that is, to do this. But underneath the playful teasing, our children too were certain of their parents' love. And again, all was right with the world. Not too long ago, our eldest son stopped in for a Saturday brunch. As logs crackled in the fireplace and music filled our home, I busied myself in the kitchen. The little boy who once reached up to me, now a young man, put his hands on my shoulders and turned me to face him, pulling me toward him for his own dance. As we swayed to the music, he looked down. I want to be like you, he said. Stunned, my response was brutally honest. Why? He tossed his head back in a brief laugh. Just do. All my mistakes, all my flaws flashed through my mind. This would not do. I did not want to waste the moment. But what to say? Take the good but leave the rest, I fairly pleaded. Another light laugh. Okay, Mom. I realize now I don't need to fear for my son. He knows my flaws, yet finds reason to love. Perhaps in following his father's example, taking our dance and making it his own, he already has claimed the best we have to offer. If the legacy of children being certain of love is what we leave behind, then sweet is the knowledge that all will be right with the world.
Jan Larson is a journalist and professor at UW-Eau Claire. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with the Wisconsin Humanities Council. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. Find more Wisconsin Life at wisconsinlife.org and on Facebook. I'm Carl Christensen.
Now, if you have raised kids or were a kid, you may remember the fascination that garbage trucks have for a lot of little ones, and not so little ones, too. It's pretty cool to see a huge vehicle raise and empty a dumpster that might weigh several hundred pounds or more. Well, one intrepid reporter decided to look into it, and she talked with parents, garbage collectors, educators, and, of course, kids themselves. Ashley Fetters is a staff writer at The Atlantic. You can find her article, Why Are Kids Obsessed with Garbage Trucks? An Investigation, over at WPR.org/Central Time. Ashley, thanks for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
When did you first realize that kids are really fascinated by garbage trucks?
Oh, that's a great question. It was over Thanksgiving that I was having dinner with a few of my brother's friends, and they talked about how much their kid just loves to go out and watch the garbage pickup every Tuesday morning and, you know, gets so sad when he misses it or for some reason they're out of town or the garbage man doesn't come that day, or it just really ruins his day, or it makes his day when he does get to say hi to the garbage man. And I remembered a similar thing myself when I was a kid, and so it just kind of made me think, man, maybe it's time to do a full investigation of why kids love garbage trucks so much.
And I have to ask, when you brought that to your editor, what was the response?
Oh, she was skeptical at first. She doesn't have children, and she kind of was like, let's make sure that this is as widespread a thing as you think it is. And I said, no problem. So it was a tougher sell at first, but she got on board pretty quickly.
Well, I think you hit on one of the things right away there when you said that your friend's child, you know, every Tuesday looks forward to it. Kids really like routines.
They do really like routines. And, you know, when I spoke to a child psychologist as well as some parents, that was kind of the first thing they brought up when I, you know, asked them point blank this question of why do kids love garbage trucks so much? And, you know, the child psychologist I spoke to pointed out that humans have always really thrived on routine. And this is just something that, you know, when you're a child with a small world and a short memory, something like this is a thing you can look forward to, but also expect in a way that makes you feel safe.
Right. And it's not like a birthday that feels like, you know, it's never going to come.
Yeah, exactly. Like she pointed out that, you know, last winter feels like such a long time ago to a 3-year-old, and your birthday can feel like such a long time ago and such a long way away. Whereas, you know, the following Tuesday is that's a sizable chunk of time. Right. It's a chunk of time that you can measure when you're a child.
Well, and I think another thing is kids like emptying things, whether it's cupboards or dumping out boxes or, you know, Tupperware bins of Legos.
Of course.
I mean, and these are people that get to do it in a really spectacular way.
Yes, of course. Kids really love that moment of chaos that ensues from dumping something out, right? And obviously, like, one thing that lots of modern garbage trucks have is that mechanical arm that reaches out to lift up a garbage can way up high in the air and dump it out. So if you're a kid, like you said, witnessing that and witnessing that all the adults seem to think it's a good thing and no one gets in trouble for it, it's pretty awesome.
Well, and you actually learned about the mechanics of garbage trucks in your very in-depth investigative report here, and you learned that there are different styles. There are the front loaders and the side loaders.
Yes, that's right. And, you know, on the streets of the United States, you tend to see all different varieties. But the one that I remember being so fascinated by that I think a lot of kids really find mesmerizing today is the automated side loader. And that's, like I mentioned, the one that has the robotic arm that juts out and, you know, grabs the can and lifts it kind of over its back to dump it out. I think that one is especially popular among among little kids.
I have to say it impresses me, too. So I guess I'm kid at heart.
Certainly a thing I came across in this story that all the adults I talked to were kind of like, yeah, it's objectively pretty cool.
We're talking with Ashley Fetters right now. She's a staff writer for The Atlantic, and she wrote the piece, Why Are Kids Obsessed with Garbage Trucks? An Investigation. And, you know, so there's the dumping things. It's also noisy, which is cool. Mm-hmm. And it's dirty. So these people are not only, you know, getting away with it, they are encouraged to make lots of noise, dump things, and touch dirty stuff all the time.
Yes, absolutely. If you've ever been around, you know, somebody who's between the ages of 3 and 7, they do tend to find that things that are stinky, you know, stinky socks, stinky garbage, stinky dirty laundry, is all very funny. I talked to the creator of the Stinky and Dirty show, that Amazon Studios series that's all about a garbage truck and a backhoe that are friends, and what he found was that even having a character named Stinky was just endlessly amusing to kids. Every time they would say that character's name on the screen, a couple of girls in the focus group would just burst out in peals of laughter. So he did find that, you know, it's a very strong appeal, stinky things and dirty things.
Well, Ashley, I'm very excited. We actually have Trevor in Okachi, who is a garbage truck driver, on the phone. So let's go there. Trevor, hello.
Hi. Yes. Thanks for having me on.
Sure. Tell us about your experiences.
Well, I'm just getting done with my day. I work for Badger Land Disposal out in Milton, Wisconsin. And I'll tell you what, I've been working for 5 years at several other places and being a garbage man, and it never fails. You go down any subdivision, any trailer home park, the kids are watching you. Some of the places you have to be really careful because a lot of the kids will follow you or run around the truck and stuff, but it's more widespread than people think it is. I always see kids looking out the windows and waving and stuff like that. So I think it's a part of it's being a machine and they're having fun watching it operate and just, you know, so that's part of it. But yeah, I see wherever I go.
And does it make your day, Trevor?
Yes, it does. It actually does because, you know, you go through your day, you deal with traffic all day, you know, you deal with people that aren't so happy with your services. And then you get little kids that just admire you and it makes you feel good at the end of the day.
Well, Trevor, thank you so much for that. And Ashley, didn't expect to get a call, but there we go. Proved exactly what you wrote about.
I love hearing it.
Well, Ashley, thanks so much for joining us. And Trevor, thanks so much for sharing, too. Ashley Fetters is a staff writer at The Atlantic. You can find her article, Why Are Kids Obsessed with Garbage Trucks? An Investigation, over at WPR.org/Central Time. Coming up, we'll talk about the history of beds and bedrooms with the author of What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. Coming up tomorrow after 7 on The Morning Show, host Keely Bultina and her guest explore bills moving through the state capitol that touch on consumer protection issues, including taxes on residential electricity and notifications of health insurance changes. Other bills would affect ride-sharing services, prescription drug disclosures, and access to vaping products. That's tomorrow morning at 7 here on the Ideas Network. Now, beds are such a common piece of furniture that we don't tend to think about them very much. But throughout history, they have been much more than a place to sleep. In fact, some rulers directed the majority of their government's affairs from their beds. And in many cultures, a beautiful bed was such a status symbol that it was placed in the main common area. Brian Fagan is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at University of California, Santa Barbara. His most recent book is What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. Brian, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
So what is the earliest type of bed that we know that our human ancestors made and used?
Well, the key is made and used because obviously people slept on the ground. But the first known beds were hollows dug out in the soil inside caves and rock shelters. But of course, they were also dug elsewhere. And the earliest we know of are some hollows in a cave in South Africa, which was occupied at least, are you ready for this date, 77,000 years ago.
Wow.
Not only that, but they were lined with grass that apparently could repel bugs collected in the nearby river bed. So you've obviously got people who were well aware of being comfortable in bed.
And not wanting to get bitten, which we can appreciate.
Indeed we can.
So what made it feasible for humans to first come down out of trees where they were sleeping to stay safe from predators and to be able to sleep safely on the ground?
This is one of the big debates of the study of very early humanity. It is clear that they slept in beds till quite late. One of the catalysts, in the end, no question, was the taming of fire. Fire enabled people to sleep on the ground, to sleep in caves, to protect themselves against predators. And one has to realize that the environment 1 million years ago, 2 million years ago, was very predator rich. It was a risky business, and you constantly had to be on the watch out for predators of different types. So when you got fire, this was an enormous step forward.
Before more modern times, humans were much more tuned into and affected by the natural cycles of seasons and daylight. So what did that mean for the time that people spent in beds and what they did there?
It's a really interesting question and a very complex one, which has been debated by scholars for a long time. There is no question that in many societies, dark was a time of dread and fear. It was a time when hidden enemies could attack you, human and otherwise, which made the fire and fat lamps made with animal fat extremely important, because they gave you a certain amount of life, light, which was important. There's no question that for much of human existence, human activity was governed very largely by the length of the daylight hours. And we know, for example, right into modern times, that Inuit hunter-gatherers up in the Arctic would actually virtually hibernate during the winter. They've found people up in northern Baffinland and the Canadian North who literally went to bed during the winter months. They would sleep under heavy furs. They would live in permanent winter houses. They would keep fires going, and they would only go out for essentials like relieving themselves or to collect food was stored, the food having been frozen and then melted. It was a very strange existence. And then, of course, in the summer, when it was light all year round, they were extremely active, fanned out into camps all over the place. And indeed, in Alaska to this day, they have basketball leagues in the summer which flourish at 2 o'clock in the morning. It's very weird to go up there. You're not used to this.
We're talking with Brian Fagan right now. He is an anthropologist, and his most recent book is What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. And Brian, I thought it was interesting that once we made the move to beds as we more or less know them today, they really haven't changed that much in form. Tell us a little bit about the beds that were in use by ancient civilizations like Mesopotamia, Rome, or Egypt.
Beds are a very, very functional tool. They are ultimately, in the final analysis, a sleeping platform, and really aren't very many forms of it which, with low technology, that you can modify very drastically. There was much more modification in modern times of the mattress rather than the bed itself. Beds are very simple artifacts. And the biggest change that you found, particularly with the early civilizations and from about 3500 BC, was that some beds were raised on legs. And to have a bed with legs for quite a long time was a sign of prestige. For example, an early old kingdom queen in Egypt of about 2500 BC had a raised gold-plated bed that she slept on in splendor. Pharaoh Tutankhamun, the golden pharaoh, the famous pharaoh, he went to his death with 4 ceremonial funerary beds and with a bed he slept on. He even had in his head a tomb, which is not widely known, a folding camp bed, the oldest we know of when he traveled. Mesopotamians has raised beds. Romans had raised beds, and these were basically very simple. I don't know how comfortable they were, but the raised bed has been around a long time.
I have to say the wooden or a carved pillows did not look particularly comfortable.
Actually, they're not that bad. I've actually slept on wooden pillows in Africa. And provided you get the angle of the bed, your body right, it's not that bad. And then, of course, there's the whole issue of sleeping on the ground. And people don't realize that even today, millions of people still sleep on the ground, not just homeless people, but people who habitually do it and think nothing of it. And there are a series of anthropological studies which show that if you're used to it and you know how to do it, it's not that bad. If you sleep, for example, on the ground in Africa, you have to be careful to make sure that you keep your genitals away from insects on the ground. And it's these little details that make all the difference. Most people who sleep on the ground have a mat or they have a pad of some sort. But it's very common and people think nothing of it. And the same is true of the pillow, the stone pillow, the timber pillow. They really were commonly used in China. I know of Victorian travelers who used them and never complained. So, you know, it's not as bad as you think.
Well, if I get the chance, I promise I will try it. I thought it was interesting that once we made the move to beds, we really started both beginning and ending our lives on them in many cases. What is the history of childbirth and beds?
Childbirth and beds is really, I wrote this book with my dear colleague and friend, Nadia Durrani, who's actually English and has a 10-year-old son. And she wrote this particular chapter. I was most interested in it. She really raised the point that hospital beds are a very recent innovation, probably the last century to two centuries. They were very dangerous in the early days because hygiene was so bad. Most people were either born in the bed at home or in a chair. And there were birth chairs. There were all sorts of ways. And the sanitized hospital bed of today is a very recent innovation by historical standards. And it's only with improved hygiene that now almost everybody, except those given birth by midwives, are in fact taken to birth in hospitals, which is probably a good thing.
Well, and it is interesting because midwives and midwifery was how virtually everyone gave birth. And then the medicalization of pregnancy and childbirth really pushed that out and brought birth into the hospitals. But there has been a movement to free women to make choices that might be more appealing to them.
It's interesting that because there was violent opposition to the notion of midwives being replaced by doctors in hospital. There was a subject of fervent opposition by the midwives and others. And it's still very popular. My view is that it's up to you, provided you're hygienic. And I think a lot of people today would agree.
We're talking with anthropologist Brian Fagan right now. He's the author of the new book, What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Does your culture or your family have particular ideas about sleeping and beds? Did you share a bed growing up, or have you co-slept with your own children? What questions do you have about beds and how we've used them over the centuries? Give us a call at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email us at ideas@wpr.org. We'll continue the conversation in just a bit. Stay with us here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Judith Sears Poisson. We're continuing our conversation now with Brian Fagan. He's a professor emeritus of anthropology at University of California, Santa Barbara. And we're talking about his most recent book, which is What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. And we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. What questions do you have about beds? Have you ever wondered why we sleep where we do with the people we do? Do you see generational differences in ideas about privacy or bringing things like electronic devices to bed? Call 800-642-1234. 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or tweet us at Central Time WPR. And we talked about childbirth, Brian, but actually we kind of skipped over an important precursor to being born. How have beds played a role in sex and reproduction?
There is an enormous literature. There is an enormous literature, for example, about the brothels which flourished in Pompeii. It is, alas, despite the fact that there were interesting graffiti in these brothels, which really were production lines. They were pretty uncomfortable places, but apparently very lucrative. Unfortunately, the academic literature is death-defyingly dull. So I don't have any nice stories to tell you. But it really, there's an awful lot of nonsense talked about sex in beds. You've got the highly formalized sexual habits of, say, Chinese and Indian emperors. You've got the very austere views of 19th century Victorian families, where often the husbands and wives slept in different beds. You've got every conceivable sort of interpretation of sexuality and of how beds are important. There is no question at all, though, that from the very earliest days, certainly from medieval times on, the notion that the bed was the place where you procreated or created children was very dominant. And of course, that continues to this day. Sex as entertainment really ties in with changing social mores. The 18th century was fairly relaxed. Parts of the 19th were. The 17th and 16th were very relaxed. The diarist Samuel Pepys had a lot of ladies in his beds, and they were not. He was not married to them, and he was not uncommon. It was a time of much greater promiscuity. Really, the biggest changes in childbirth, I believe, or in having children, has been the advent of efficient birth control. But that's really outside my expertise. I'm an archaeologist.
Yes. Well, you talked about the royal beds as well in your book. And I found it fascinating that many rulers, whether royal or elected, you know, really led their countries and did the government business from the comfort of their bed. Do you have some favorite anecdotes to share?
Oh, this is a lovely subject. The most famous recent one, of course, is Winston Churchill. And Winston Churchill literally lived in his bed, drank in his bed, dictated to secretaries there, interviewed generals and his chiefs of staff and prime minister, and smoked cigars. And you can actually see the place in London, the war rooms in London, which actually, if you go there and look at them, are fascinating. He was really, he held audience from his bed. He did the same when he traveled to Morocco, and that sort of thing. He was a great man, but a very strange one in some ways. Another very famous one is the Sun King Louis XIV of France, who really held court in bed. It was a huge privilege for a courtier to be invited to witness the getting up and dressing of the king and the king going to bed. These were formal occasions, and often 100 people would be there. He also ate in public, and his bed was a platform. And if you were asked to spend the night in the king's bed, which was nothing sexual often, it was a sign of extreme favor, because the big thing that drove the dynamics and the factionalism in the French court was the king's favor. And the king knew it, and the king made very effective use of it as well. And there were all kinds of stories about how people tried to curry favor with him. But really, it's a question of royal presence. You were in the royal presence. Egyptian pharaohs' beds were different. They were definitely places where you procreated. And there was a famous tomb scene of a noble and his wife going to bed. And it's clear that the whole purpose of this is A, to have sex, and B, to produce an heir, a son. So you've got all kinds of graphic representations. That the thing is, until recently, sharing a bed was no big deal. Today, you would go to a hotel, you might share a bed with a complete stranger. Today, of course, it's very different.
Well, and Brian, you talk about the bed that is quite the centerpiece at the Victoria and Albert Museum in London. I just happened to see that in August for the first time. It's this huge bed that they advertised for travelers that it could sleep 12 people.
Oh, indeed. And they would, if I may quote the contemporary literature, are said to have floricked in the bed. So, yeah, it was a famous tourist attraction. It still is. In fact, in 2012, the English Lottery gave money and they disassembled it, which was very difficult, took it to a little museum at this place called Ware, because the bed was built and used in a hotel in Ware, which is a small town. And it was a huge sensation to have the bed exhibited in Ware. But I'm glad you saw it. It's very famous.
It is, and it's big. I think it would still be hard to put 12 people on it, but
it would be crowded. But they didn't mind. You didn't, of course, lie in it, did you?
No, I did not. No. I didn't want to get kicked out.
I think the last person who did that was Elizabeth Hurley, if I recall.
I think you're right, and she got in trouble. We are talking with Brian Fagan about his book, What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. And Brian, in the last decade or so, technology has changed just about every aspect of our lives. That also goes for our beds and our sleep as well.
Well, this is fascinating. I mean, I'm an archaeologist, and people say to me, how the hell did you get involved with writing a book about beds? This is relevant to the story. And it happened because I had a man I knew at Cambridge University many years before who called me and said, would you give a lecture on the history of beds to a small group of mattress company executives because they're merging and we're trying to widen their perspective? And I did it. And the next thing I found, my publisher wanted a book on the subject. So I came into this from the outside. But what is really fascinating, and these were really smart people, very, very good at their jobs, is how very sophisticated the selling of mattresses and beds is. And a lot of it today focuses not on the magic of 8 hours of good sleep. I mean, they monitor your sleep now if you want it, but whether you're plugged in to the web, how you can adjust the bed for one person and for another. It goes on and on and on. The big search is always for comfort and convenience. And the biggest trend now, of course, with much more high-density living, is that more and more people are getting beds which they can sleep in small spaces. Other people are moving into what they would call pods, where they have literally a media center around their bed. So the Murphy bed has become just the folding bed that goes on the wall, is kind of coming into its own. It really is a time of major change, especially for mattress companies.
And very briefly, Brian, what does the history of beds tell us about us as humans?
It tells us that we're very sociable. It tells us that being close to people is very important. It, in recent centuries, has placed a high premium on how much we value comfort and protection and warmth. One of the biggest things about a bed is it can give you warmth because it's cozy. I would say just very basic things, really.
And we'll leave it there, Brian. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, my pleasure.
Brian Fagan is Professor Emeritus of Anthropology at University of California, Santa Barbara. He was with us to talk about his most recent book, What We Did in Bed, A Horizontal History. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, according to the people at the Merriam-Webster Dictionary, they as a singular pronoun is the word of the year. We'll find out about its long history before current uses in the multigendered context. And we'll look back at the biggest Wisconsin news stories of the last decade, and we'll ask you which ones stand out. Weekdays from 6 to 9 a.m., it's the morning show. Tomorrow after 6:30, if you're feeling defeated about actually keeping your resolutions this year, you're not alone. A psychologist joins Keely Boltina to help us understand why resolutions are so hard to keep, and she'll give advice on how to stick with it this year. That's tomorrow morning at 6:30, right here on the Ideas Network. Coming up next, it's the news from NPR and WPR. And then FOMO is the fear of missing out. What about FOMA, the fear of missing alcohol? We'll talk about what being sober can be like when alcohol is woven into so many aspects of being social, especially in a state like Wisconsin. I'm Judith Sears-Poisson, in for Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.